Ashendon by W. Somerset Maugham. Chapter 2. A Domiciliary Visit. Ashendon was on his way back to Geneva. The night was stormy and the wind blew cold from the mountains, but the stodgy little steamer plodded sturdily through the choppy waters of the lake. A scudding rain, just turning into sleet, swept the deck in angry gusts like a nagging woman who cannot leave a subject alone. Ashendon had been to France in order to write and dispatch a report. A day or two before, about 5 in the afternoon, an Indian agent of his had come to see him in his rooms. It was only by a lucky chance that he was in, for he had no appointment with him, and the agent's instructions were to come to the hotel only in a case of urgent importance. He told Ashendon that a Bengali in the German service had recently come from Berlin with a black cane trunk in which were a number of documents interesting to the British government. At that time, the Central Powers were doing their best to foment such an agitation in India as would make it necessary for Great Britain to keep their troops in the country and perhaps send others from France. It had been found possible to get the Bengali arrested in Bern on a charge that would keep him out of harm's way for a while, but the black cane trunk couldn't be found. Ashendon's agent was a very brave and very clever fellow, and he mixed freely with such of his countrymen as were disaffected to the interests of Great Britain. He had just discovered that the Bengali, before going to Bern, had, for greater safety, left the trunk in a cloakroom at Zurich Station, and now that he was in jail, awaiting trial, was unable to get the bulletin by which it might be obtained into the hands of any of his confederates. It was a matter of great urgency for the German intelligence department to secure the contents of the trunk without delay, and since it was impossible for them to get hold of it by the ordinary official means, they had decided to break into the station that very night and steal it. It was a bold and ingenious scheme, and Ashendon felt a pleasant exhilaration, for a great deal of his work was uncommonly dull, when he heard of it. He recognized the dashing and unscrupulous touch of the head of the German Secret Service at Bern. But the burglary was arranged for 2 o'clock in the following morning, and there was not a moment to lose. He could trust neither the telegraph nor the telephone to communicate with the British officer at Bern, and since the Indian agent could not go, he was taking his life in his hands by coming to see Ashendon, and if he were noticed leaving his room, it might easily be that he'd be found one day floating in the lake with a knife thrust in his back. There was nothing for it but to go himself. There was a train to Bern that he could just catch, and he put on his hat and coat as he ran downstairs. He jumped into a cab. 4 hours later, he rang the bell of the headquarters of the intelligence department. His name was known there but to one person, and it was for him that Ashendon asked. A tall, tired-looking man, whom he had not met before, came out and without a word led him into an office. Ashendon told him his errand. The tall man looked at his watch. "It's too late for us to do anything ourselves. We couldn't possibly get to Zurich in time," he reflected. "We'll put the Swiss authorities on the job. They can telephone, and when your friends attempt their little burglary, I have no doubt they'll find the station well guarded. Anyhow, you'd better get back to Geneva." He shook hands with Ashendon and showed him out. Ashendon was well aware that he would never know what happened then. Being no more than a tiny rivet in a vast and complicated machine, he never had the advantage of seeing a completed action. He was concerned with the beginning or the end of it, perhaps, or with some incident in the middle, but what his own doings led to, he had seldom a chance of discovering. It was as unsatisfactory as those modern novels that give you a number of unrelated episodes and expect you, by piecing them together, to construct in your mind a connected narrative. Notwithstanding his fur coat and his muffler, Ashendon was chilled to the bone. It was warm in the saloon, and there were good lights to read by, but he thought it better not to sit there in case some habitual traveler, recognizing him, wondered why he made these constant journeys between Geneva in Switzerland and Thonon in France. And so, making the best of what shelter could be found, he passed the tedious time in the darkness of the deck. He looked in the direction of Geneva, but could see no lights, and the sleet, turning into snow, prevented him from recognizing the landmarks. Lac Clément, on fine days so trim and pretty, artificial like a piece of water in a French garden, in this tempestuous weather was as secret and as menacing as the sea. He made up his mind that on getting back to his hotel, he would have a fire lit in his sitting room, a hot bath, and dinner comfortably by the fireside in pajamas and a dressing gown. The prospect of spending an evening by himself with his pipe and a book was so agreeable that it made the misery of that journey across the lake positively worthwhile. Two sailors tramped past him heavily, their heads bent down to save themselves from the sleet that blew in their faces, and one of them shouted to him, "Nous arrivons!" They went to the side and withdrew a bar to allow passage for the gangway, and looking again, Ashenden, through the howling darkness, saw mistily the lights of the quay. A welcome sight. In 2 or 3 minutes, the steamer was made fast, and Ashenden, muffled to the eyes, joined himself to the little knot of passengers that waited to step ashore. Though he made the journey so often, it was his duty to cross that lake into France once a week to deliver his reports and to receive instructions. He had always a faint sense of trepidation when he stood among the crowd at the gangway and waited to land. There was nothing on his passport to show that he had been in France. The steamer went round the lake, touching French soil at 2 places, but going from Switzerland to Switzerland, so that his journey would have been to Vevey or to Lausanne. But he could never be sure that the secret police had not taken note of him, and if he'd been followed and seen to land in France, the fact that there was no stamp on his passport would be difficult to explain. Of course he had his story ready, but he well knew that it was not a very convincing one, and though it might be impossible for the Swiss authorities to prove that he was anything but a casual traveler, he might nevertheless spend 2 or 3 days in jail, which would be uncomfortable, and then be firmly conducted to the frontier, which would be mortifying. The Swiss knew well that their country was the scene of all manner of intrigues. Agents of the Secret Service, spies, revolutionaries, and agitators infested the hotels of the principal towns, and jealous of their neutrality, they were determined to prevent conduct that might embroil them with any of the belligerent powers. There were, as usual, 2 police officers on the quay to watch the passengers disembark, and Ashenden, walking past them with as unconcerned an air as he could assume, was relieved when he had got safely by. The darkness swallowed him up, and he stepped out briskly for his hotel. The wild weather, with a scornful gesture, had swept all the neatness from the trim promenade. The shops were closed, and Ashenden passed only an occasional pedestrian who sidled along, scrunched up, as though he fled from the blind wrath of the unknown. You had a feeling in that black and bitter night that civilization, ashamed of its artificiality, cowered before the fury of elemental things. It was hail now that blew in Ashenden's face, and the pavement was wet and slippery so that he had to walk with caution. The hotel faced the lake. When he reached it, and a page boy opened the door for him, he entered the hall with a flurry of wind that sent the papers on the porter's desk flying into the air. Ashenden was dazzled by the light. He stopped to ask the porter if there were letters for him. There was nothing, and he was about to get into the lift when the porter told him that 2 gentlemen were waiting in his room to see him. Ashenden had no friends in Geneva. "Oh?" he answered, not a little surprised. "Who are they?" He'd taken care to get on friendly terms with the porter, and his tips for trifling services had been generous. The porter gave a discreet smile. "There's no harm in telling you. I think they're members of the police." "What do they want?" asked Ashenden. "They didn't say. They asked me where you were, and I told them you'd gone for a walk. They said they would wait till you came back." "How long have they been there?"
"An hour."
Ashenden's heart sank, but he took care not to let his face betray his concern. "I'll go up and see them," he said. The liftman stood aside to let him step into the lift, but Ashenden shook his head. "I'm so cold," he said. "I think I'll walk up." He wished to give himself a moment to think. But as he ascended the three flights slowly, his feet were like lead. There could be small doubt why two police officers were so bent upon seeing him. He felt on a sudden dreadfully tired. He didn't feel he could cope with a multitude of questions. And if he were arrested as a secret agent, he must spend at least the night in a cell. He longed more than ever for a hot bath and a pleasant dinner by his fireside. He had half a mind to turn tail and walk out of the hotel, leaving everything behind him. He had his passport in his pocket, and he knew by heart the hours at which trains started for the frontier. Before the Swiss authorities had made up their minds what to do, he would be in safety. But he continued to trudge upstairs. He didn't like the notion of abandoning his job so easily. He'd been sent to Geneva, knowing the risks, to do work of a certain kind, and it seemed to him that he'd better go through with it. Of course, it would not be very nice to spend 2 years in a Swiss prison, but the chance of this was, like assassination to kings, one of the inconveniences of his profession. He reached the landing of the third floor and walked to his room. Ashenden had in him, it seems, a strain of flippancy, on account of which, indeed, the critics had often reproached him, and as he stood for a moment outside the door, his predicament appeared to him on a sudden rather droll. His spirits went up, and he determined to brazen the thing out. It was with a genuine smile on his lips that he turned the handle and, entering the room, faced his visitors. "Good evening, gentlemen," he said. The room was brightly lit, for all the lights were on, and a fire burned in the hearth. The air was gray with smoke, since the strangers, finding it long to wait for him, had been smoking strong and inexpensive cigars. They sat in their great coats and bowler hats as though they had only just that moment come in, but the ashes and the little tray on the table would alone have suggested that they'd been there long enough to make themselves familiar with their surroundings. They were two powerful men, with black mustaches on the stout side, heavily built, and they reminded Ashenden of Fafner and Fossolt, the giants in the Rheingold. Their clumsy boots, the massive way they sat in their chairs, and the ponderous alertness of their expression made it obvious that they were members of the detective force. Ashenden gave his room an enveloping glance. He was a neat creature and saw at once that his things, though not in disorder, were not as he'd left them. He guessed that an examination had been made of his effects. That didn't disturb him, for he kept in his room no document that would compromise him. His code he'd learned by heart and destroyed before leaving England, and such communications as reached him from Germany were handed to him by third parties and transmitted without delay to the proper places. There was nothing he need fear in a search, but the impression that it had been made confirmed his suspicion that he'd been denounced to the authorities as a secret agent. "What can I do for you, gentlemen?" he asked affably. "It's warm in here. Wouldn't you like to take off your coats and hats?" It faintly irritated him that they should sit there with their hats on. "We're only staying a minute," said one of them. "We were passing, and as the concierge said you would be in at once, we thought we would wait." He didn't remove his hat. Ashenden unwrapped his scarf and disembrassed himself of his heavy coat. "Won't you have a cigar?" he asked, offering the box to the two detectives in turn. "Don't mind if I do," said the first, Fafner, taking one, upon which the second, Fossolt, helped himself without a word, even of thanks. The name on the box appeared to have a singular effect on their manners, for both now took off their hats. "You must have had a very disagreeable walk in this bad weather," said Fafner, as he bit half an inch off the end of his cigar and spat it in the fireplace. Now it was Ashenden's principle, a good one in life as well as in the intelligence department, always to tell as much of the truth as he conveniently could. So he answered as follows. "What do you take me for? I wouldn't go out in such weather if I could help it. I had to go to Vevey today to see an invalid friend, and I came back by boat. It was bitter on the lake." "We come from the police," said Fafner casually. Ashenden thought they must consider him a perfect idiot if they imagined he'd not long discovered that. but it was not a piece of information to which it was discreet to reply with a pleasantry. "Oh, really?" he said. "Have you your passport on you?" "Yes, in these war times I think a foreigner is wise always to keep his passport on him." "Very wise." Ashington handed the men the nice new passport, which gave no information about his movements, other than that he had come from London 3 months before, and had since then crossed no frontier. The detective looked at it carefully and passed it on to his colleague. "It appears to be all in order," he said. Ashington, standing in front of the fire to warm himself, a cigarette between his lips, made no reply. He watched the detectives warily, but with an expression, he flattered himself, of amiable unconcern. Fazelt handed back the passport to Fafner, who tapped it reflectively with a thick forefinger. "The chief of police told us to come here," he said, and Ashington was conscious that both of them now looked at him with attention, "to make a few inquiries of you." Ashington knew that when you have nothing apposite to say, it's better to hold your tongue, and when a man has made a remark that calls to his mind for an answer, he's apt to find silence a trifle disconcerting. Ashington waited for the detective to proceed. He was not quite sure, but it seemed to him that he hesitated. "It appears that there have been a good many complaints lately of the noise that people make when they come out of the casino late at night. We wish to know if you personally have been troubled by the disturbance. It is evident that as your rooms look out on the lake and the revelers pass your windows, if the noise is serious, you must have heard it." For an instant, Ashington was dumbfounded. What balderdash was this the detective was talking to him? Boom, boom, he heard the big drum as the giant lumbered on the scene. And why on earth should the chief of police send to him to find out if his beauty sleep had been disturbed by vociferous gamblers? It looked very like a trap. But nothing is so foolish as to ascribe profundity to what on the surface is merely inept. It's a pitfall into which many an ingenuous reviewer has fallen headlong. Ashington had a confident belief in the stupidity of the human animal, which in the course of his life had stood him in good stead. It flashed across him that if the detective asked him such a question, it was because he had no shadow of proof that he was engaged in any illegal practice. It was clear that he had been denounced, but no evidence had been offered, and the search of his rooms had been fruitless. But what a silly excuse was this to make for a visit, and what a poverty of invention it showed. Ashington immediately thought of three reasons the detective might have given for seeking an interview with him, and he wished that he were on terms sufficiently familiar with them to make the suggestions. This was really an insult to the intelligence. These men were even stupider than he thought. But Ashington had always a soft corner in his heart for the stupid, and now he looked upon them with a feeling of unexpected kindliness. He would have liked to pat them gently, but he answered the question with gravity. "To tell you the truth, I'm a very sound sleeper, the result doubtless of a pure heart and an easy conscience, and I have never heard a thing." Ashton looked at them for the faint smile that he thought his remark deserved, but their countenances remained stolid. Ashington, as well as an agent of the British government, was a humorist, and he stifled the beginnings of a sigh. He assumed a slightly imposing air and adopted a more serious tone. "But even if I had been awakened by noisy people, I should not dream of complaining. At a time when there's so much trouble, misery, and unhappiness in the world, I cannot think it very wrong to disturb the amusement of persons who are lucky enough to be able to amuse themselves." "En effet," said the detective, "but the fact remains that people have been disturbed, and the chief of police thought the matter should be inquired into." His colleague, who had hitherto preserved a silence that was positively sphinx-like, now broke it. "I notice by your passport that you are an author, monsieur," he said. Ashington, in reaction from his previous perturbation, was feeling exceedingly debonair, and he answered with good humor. "It is true. It's a profession full of tribulation, but it has now and then its compensations." "La gloire," said Fafner politely. or shall we say notoriety, hazarded Ashenden. And what are you doing in Geneva? The question was put so pleasantly that Ashenden felt it behooved him to be on his guard. A police officer amiable is more dangerous to the wise than a police officer aggressive. I'm writing a play, said Ashenden. He waved his hand to the papers on his table. Four eyes followed his gesture. A casual glance told him that the detectives had looked and taken note of his manuscripts. And why should you write a play here rather than in your own country? Ashenden smiled upon them with even more affability than before, since this was a question for which he had long been prepared, and it was a relief to give the answer. He was curious to see how it would go down. Mais, monsieur, there is a war. My country is in a turmoil. It would be impossible to sit there quietly and write a play. Is it a comedy or a tragedy? Oh, a comedy, and a light one at that, replied Ashenden. The artist needs peace and quietness. How do you expect him to preserve that detachment of spirit that's demanded by creative work unless he can have perfect tranquility? Switzerland has the good fortune to be neutral, and it seemed to me that in Geneva I should find the very surroundings I wanted. Fafner nodded slightly to Fasolt, but whether to indicate that he thought Ashenden an imbecile, or whether in sympathy with his desire for a safe retreat from a turbulent world, Ashenden had no means of knowing. Anyhow, the detective evidently came to the conclusion that he could learn nothing more from talking to Ashenden, for his remarks grew now desultory, and in a few minutes he rose to go. When Ashenden, having warmly shaken their hands, closed the door behind the pair, he heaved a great sigh of relief. He turned on the water for his bath, as hot as he thought he could possibly bear it, and as he undressed, reflected comfortably over his escape. The day before, an incident had occurred that had left him on his guard. There was in his service a Swiss, known in the intelligence department as Bernard, who had recently come from Germany, and Ashenden had instructed him to go to a certain café, desiring to see him at a certain time. Since he'd not seen him before, so that there might be no mistake, he had informed him through an intermediary what question himself would ask and what reply he was to give. He chose the luncheon hour for the meeting, since then the café was unlikely to be crowded, and it chanced that on entering he saw but one man of about the age he knew Bernard to be. He was by himself, and going up to him, Ashenden casually put to him the prearranged question. The prearranged answer was given, and sitting down beside him, Ashenden ordered himself a Dubonnet. The spy was a stocky little fellow, shabbily dressed, with a bullet-shaped head, close-cropped, fair, with shifty blue eyes and a sallow skin. He did not inspire confidence, and but that, Ashenden knew by experience how hard it was to find men willing to go into Germany, he would have been surprised that his predecessor had engaged him. He was a German Swiss and spoke French with a strong accent. He immediately asked for his wages, and these Ashenden passed over to him in an envelope. They were in Swiss francs. He gave a general account of his stay in Germany and answered Ashenden's careful questions. He was by calling a waiter, and had found a job in a restaurant near one of the Rhine bridges, which gave him good opportunity to get the information that was required of him. His reasons for coming to Switzerland for a few days were plausible, and there could apparently be no difficulty in his crossing the frontier on his return. Ashenden expressed his satisfaction with his behavior, gave him his orders, and was prepared to finish the interview. "Very good," said Bernard. "But before I go back to Germany, I want 2,000 francs." "Do you?" "Yes, and I want them now, before you leave this café. It's a sum I have to pay, and I've got to have it." "I'm afraid I can't give it to you." A scowl made the man's face even more unpleasant to look at than it was before. "You've got to." "What makes you think that?" The spy leaned forward, and not raising his voice, but speaking so that only Ashenden could hear, burst out angrily. "Do you think I'm going on risking my life for that beggarly sum you give me? Not 10 days ago a man was caught at Mainz and shot. Was that one of your men? We haven't got anyone at Mainz, said Ashenden, carelessly, and for all he knew it was true. He'd been puzzled not to receive his usual communications from that place, and Bernard's information might afford the explanation. You knew exactly what you were to get when you took on the job, and if you weren't satisfied, you needn't have taken it. I have no authority to give you a penny more. Do you see what I've got here? Said Bernard. He took a small revolver out of his pocket and fingered it significantly. What are you going to do with it? Pawn it? With an angry shrug of the shoulders, he put it back in his pocket. Ashenden reflected that had he known anything of the technique of the theater, Bernard would have been aware that it was useless to make a gesture that had no ulterior meaning. You refuse to give me the money? Certainly. The spy's manner, which at first had been obsequious, was now somewhat truculent, but he kept his head and never for a moment raised his voice. Ashenden could see that Bernard, however big a ruffian, was a reliable agent, and he made up his mind to suggest to R that his salary should be raised. The scene diverted him. A little way off, two fat citizens of Geneva, with black beards, were playing dominoes, and on the other side a young man with spectacles was with great rapidity writing sheet after sheet of an immensely long letter. A Swiss family, who knows, perhaps Robinson by name, consisting of a father and mother and four children, were sitting around a table making the best of two small cups of coffee. The cassier behind the counter, an imposing brunette with a large bust encased in black silk, was reading the local paper. The surroundings made the melodramatic scene in which Ashenden was engaged perfectly grotesque. His own play seemed to him much more real. Bernard smiled. His smile was not engaging. Do you know I have only to go to the police and tell them about you to have you arrested? Do you know what a Swiss prison is like? No, I've often wondered lately. Do you? Yes, and you wouldn't like it much. One of the things that had bothered Ashenden was the possibility that he would be arrested before he finished his play. He disliked the notion of leaving it half done for an indefinite period. He didn't know whether he would be treated as a political prisoner or as a common criminal, and he had a mind to ask Bernard whether in the latter case, the only one Bernard was likely to know anything about, he would be allowed writing materials. He was afraid Bernard would think the inquiry an attempt to laugh at him, but he was feeling comparatively at ease and was able to answer Bernard's threat without heat. You could, of course, get me sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. At least. No, that is the maximum, I understand, and I think it's quite enough. I won't conceal from you that I should find it extremely disagreeable, but not nearly so disagreeable as you would. What could you do? Oh, we'd get you somehow. And after all, the war won't last forever. You're a waiter. You want your freedom of action. I promise you that if I get into any trouble, you will never be admitted into any of the Allied countries for the rest of your life. I can't help thinking it would cramp your style. Bernard didn't reply, but looked down sulkily at the marble-topped table. Ashenden thought this was a moment to pay for the drinks and go. Think it over, Bernard, he said. If you want to go back to your job, you have your instructions, and your usual wages shall be paid through the usual channels. The spy shrugged his shoulders, and Ashenden, though not knowing in the least what was the result of their conversation, felt that it behooved him to walk out with dignity. He did so. And now, as he carefully put one foot into the bath, wondering if he could bear it, he asked himself what Bernard had in the end decided on. The water was just not scalding, and he gradually let himself down into it. On the whole, it seemed to him that the spy had thought it would be as well to go straight, and the source of his denunciation must be looked for elsewhere. Perhaps in the hotel itself. Ashenden lay back, and as his body grew used to the heat of the water, gave a sigh of satisfaction. Really, he reflected, there are moments in life when all this to-do that has led from the primeval slime to myself seems almost worthwhile. Ashenden could not but think he was lucky to have wriggled out of the fix he had found himself in that afternoon. Had he been arrested and in due course sentenced, R, shrugging his shoulders, would merely have called him a damned fool and set about looking for someone to take his place. Already Ashenden knew his chief well enough to be aware that when he'd told him that if he got into trouble, he need look for no help, he meant exactly what he said.